I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. It took a while, but last week, federal prosecutors finally charged New Jersey Senator Robert Menendez with multiple counts of corruption involving his relationship with Florida eye doctor Salmon Melgen. Prosecutors allege that Menendez did favors for the doctor in exchange for trips and dinners, fancy vacations, including lavish hotel rooms, along with generous political contributions. Menendez said he did nothing wrong, that the charges are completely false. We asked Matt Friedman to join us once again. He's been covering this story, and he also covers New Jersey politics for the Star-Ledger. And Matt Friedman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, glad to be here.
So how long had the senator been under investigation by the feds?
A little over 2 years. I think grand jury started looking into it in early 2013. He's been under investigation by the feds before as well. So, but for this particular one, about 2 years.
And this was it's a 14-count indictment. What's included in this indictment?
Well, it ranges from bribery to, you know, very simple counts of failing to report gifts. And that really, you know, and just as the seriousness of the counts seem to go along with just how hard they are to prove. The bribery ones are probably the hardest to prove. But as far as reporting the gifts, well, if he really did get some of the really extravagant gifts outlined in this indictment, it's pretty clear he didn't report them, so... That's a different animal.
Well, what kind of gifts are we talking about here? I've read some of the indictment.
Well, we're talking about many more flights than the senator ever admitted to receiving from Melgen, most if not all of which he didn't pay for until much later. We're talking about a stay in Paris for a hotel room, a very luxurious hotel room with some very nice bathroom facilities that were mentioned in the indictment that I think ran for the entire stay about roughly $5,000, golf outings with Dr. Melgen, and on and on, just a lot of really nice things and a lot of nice travel.
This is a very nice hotel room, and he wanted Melgen, I guess, to use his bonus points to pay for the room. He wanted a king-size bed, a, quote, limestone bath with soaking tub and enclosed rain shower, and apparently a very nice view as well.
That's true, and this is the first time I think I've ever heard of a bribery charge involving credit card points or airline miles, so it's something new.
Who is this Melgen, this Dr. Melgen?
Melgen is a very prominent and successful eye doctor in southern Florida. He's originally from the Dominican Republic, and he is a major, major campaign donor. He is also Medicare's top biller for a particular eye procedure that is really at the center of this indictment, in that he was reusing doses that were left over in vials. When he's only supposed to use one dose for a vial, he was using three, and allegedly he was charging Medicare as if he had used three vials, when in fact he wasn't only paying one. And Menendez allegedly, and it's pretty clearly documented in the indictment, went to bat for Dr. Melgen in trying to make sure that he didn't have to pay back $9 million Medicare said it was owed.
And this is where, and we'll be talking later with the head of Common Cause in more detail about this, but this is where it gets, I guess, tricky, Matt, to figure out quid pro quo, you know, whether one has to do with the other.
That's always the tricky part in these indictments, and that's why, you know, a lot of the indictments that they bring fail. But I also think the Justice Department, realizing that they've had a very rocky history with trying to indict sitting U.S. senators, which doesn't happen very often, they probably wouldn't have brought this if they didn't feel pretty confident about it. Still, it is certainly not a slam dunk. That minor charge should be, but the rest of this, really, it's a whole other thing when you're trying to actually prove the quid pro quo.
And how generous has Melgen been to Senator Menendez? And it seems to go through a super PAC that was controlled to some degree by Harry Reid.
Yeah, that's right. Dr. Melgen gave $700,000 to this super PAC. I think $600,000 was earmarked specifically for Senator Menendez's 2012 re-election. He's given all kinds of donations to Senator Menendez, his legal fund directly when he was facing a recall effort by a Tea Party group. And Also, something that hasn't got a lot of attention is in local, you know, for the local ground game for Menendez's 2012 reelection effort, Dr. Melgen cut $25,000 checks to several New Jersey county political parties. And, you know, at the time, I even talked a couple years ago, I talked to the Union County Democratic chairwoman who told me that, yeah, we asked Menendez for the money, and he said, I'll see what I can do. And then the check came from Dr. Melgen, who they never met. So when Senator Menendez has needed campaign funds, Dr. Melgen has been there for him.
And Dr. Melgen lives in Florida. He does not live in New Jersey.
And that's correct. And that's another point that maybe makes the Justice Department feel a little more confident about quid pro quo, because it's easy for senators to say, I'm just helping out a constituent if they live in the state you represent. But Dr. Melgen lives 1,000 miles from the state Menendez represents. So it's another, you know, he can't make the claim that he's just looking out for one of his constituents, and a prominent one at that.
Matt, you and I have talked about this before a couple of weeks ago, I guess in anticipation of this indictment. This began also with an investigation having to do with prostitution. I believe unfounded investigation, but that seemed to be what sparked this whole larger investigation.
That's true, and this has been an extremely murky case, because someone was, when Menendez says someone was out to get him, he's not lying. There was someone out there. He's suggesting the Cuban government. We don't know. But someone was out there trying to take Menendez down, and there were allegations being pushed to many media outlets about these prostitution allegations. And none of the media outlets except the Daily Caller took them up because they couldn't be substantiated. We're not going to run with something days before an election that really is from a sketchy source and has no real evidence. Those have been largely discredited. One prostitute came out and said she was paid to say it. It's still kind of murky circumstances around there. And even the tipster who was making these anonymous allegations went by the name Pete Williams, which is the name of the last New Jersey senator to face corruption.
And you don't know who this is, Matt? Or do you?
No, we don't. Nobody does. There's been a lot of speculation. There's been speculation that, you know, some sugar barons who Menendez fell out with were behind it. There's been speculation that it's the Cuban government. There's been speculation that it's just regular political opponents. Nobody's quite sure where the prostitution allegations emanated from. But once the Fed started looking into that, and once the media started looking into it, these other more substantial allegations that this indictment is really based around started to come to light, though still only a fraction of one of the most, you know, perhaps damning, just from a public relations standpoint, charges. And there is that Senator Menendez intervened to get visas for three foreign girlfriends for Dr. Melgen, who, by the way, is married, three foreign girlfriends into the country, including one that was rejected the first time. And Menendez stepped in and got it approved.
Wow. So he had a press conference about a week ago, and obviously he's very defiant. He's fighting the charges. What has been, I guess, his charge against this federal investigation?
He's vaguely said it's politicized. The obvious implication there is that, you know, Senator Menendez has never been really an ally of President Obama's in any real sense. He's definitely been a thorn in his side on the Iran policy, and he's very much opposed the attack with Cuba that the Obama administration has taken. So when he talks about it being politically motivated, everyone assumes that's what he's talking about, though he's not elaborating. And he's actually, strangely, had some support from the right on that front. There's a lot of Republicans who are suggesting that Menendez is the target of a vengeful Obama. Never mind that this investigation started 2 years ago, you know, before a lot of these issues really come to the forefront. And at the same time, it's basically been very vocal support for Senator Menendez by Democrats, especially New Jersey Democrats, and mostly silence from Republicans, including Governor Christie here in New Jersey, who's only said that he's due his day in court, which actually is inconsistent for Governor Christie, who Democrats or Republicans, when lower-level officials, state-level officials, have been indicted on corruption charges. He has said, it's his thing, he's like, when people are indicted on corruption charges, you'll hear me call on them to resign. He did that for former Trenton Mayor Tony Mack, a Democrat, former Hamilton Mayor John Benchavango, a Republican, Assemblyman Bob Schroeder, a Republican, but he's not doing it for Bob Menendez.
Christie took a trip recently to the Middle East that was paid for by one of the heads of countries there.
Yeah, and my colleague Charlie Style in the Bergen Record even suggested, well, he might not want to throw stones on that one because he's had gifts paid for by, you know, he's had hotel rooms paid for by the King of Jordan. He had a, you know, flight to the Middle East paid for by Sheldon Adelson, the casino billionaire, who certainly has an interest in how, you know, how the state pursues sports betting and other gambling issues. So it's also, you're right, in that sense, it's not easy territory for Christie to criticize.
Now, Menendez did resign. This is a pretty powerful position. He had minority leader of the Foreign Relations Committee. Do I have that right? Foreign Relations?
The names vary based on whether it's House or Senate, but he was, you know, when the Democrats had the majority in the Senate, he was the chairman, and now he's the ranking Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee. So he said he's stepping down from that temporarily while he fights these charges. The good thing for Menendez here is that he's not up for re-election until 2018. But I do think that as this drags on and if it starts getting really ugly, some of that support might get a little softer.
Fighting the charges is going to cost him money. Does Senator Menendez, does he have a big bank account?
Yes, Senator Menendez has a huge legal defense fund. You know, even before the indictments came out, he had raised about $1 million in legal funds, most of it in this legal defense fund. He has a lot of support. You know, a lot of that money actually came from the pro-Israel community, a couple hundred thousand dollars from them, I think. I think he'll be able to continue to tap that well. And I think, you know, on April 15th or so, or right around then, we'll get to see what his latest fundraising haul for his legal defense is. He's also mounting a public relations campaign now that's, as far as I can tell, coming out of his campaign account. That is also not going to be cheap. It doesn't cost much to establish a hashtag, but to get any real presence out there, it's going to cost some money. So it's going to be an expensive ordeal for him. The one thing about him, as we've seen, is he's good at raising money.
Well, and the hashtag is I Stand With Bob, right? Started by some members of his staff?
Yeah, the main person behind this is Michael Solomon, who's this former state director who now works at Mercury Public Affairs, which is a, you know, PR and political consulting firm where actually Christie's strategist Mike Duhaime is a partner. So you see some kind of connections there, too.
Matt, we're almost out of time here. How is this playing among the public in New Jersey? Any way to tell yet?
Yeah, well, there was just a poll released yesterday morning that had some interesting results, which is that a majority still feel, even after the indictment, that Senator Menendez does not need to step down unless he's convicted. That could change as this gets more into the public consciousness. And it also did show it taking its toll on him after the indictment. And this is a very, you have to kind of take this with a grain because it's a very small sample. But after the indictment came out, people's perception definitely shifted in terms of his both favorable and approval rating. It went from a net positive approval rating to a split even approval rating. And that's just 1 week after the indictment. And from my experience, when people are in a lot of trouble, it takes a few weeks to really reflect fully in the polls.
Matt Friedman, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times.
All right, thank you.
You're very welcome. He's been covering the case against New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez and covers New Jersey politics for the Star-Ledger. We're going to take a very short break, and then we have Miles Rappaport waiting in the wings. He's president of Common Cause. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. New Jersey Senator Robert Menendez was indicted last week on bribery and other charges after a multi-year investigation into his relationship with a Florida eye doctor who was a generous supporter of Menendez's re-election campaign and had lavished him with fancy trips and gifts. The feds claim that the senator returned the favor by intervening on the doctor's behalf with several government agencies. Menendez has countered that federal prosecutors don't know the difference between friendship and corruption, and he is fighting these charges. Joining us now is Miles Rappaport. He's the president of Common Cause. That's a nonprofit, nonpartisan citizens lobbying organization that promotes open, honest, and accountable government. And Miles Rappaport, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Glad to be with you.
You're very welcome. Let me just give out some ways that our listeners can join the conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. Miles, when was the last time a sitting senator was indicted? Do you know?
It's been a while since I think there was the Abscam scandal in other New Jersey One, there have been several sitting governors who have been indicted very recently, and in some cases, in circumstances somewhat similar to the Menendez case, including Governor McDonnell in Virginia, Governor John Rowland in Connecticut, my home state. So this is clearly, an issue that goes widely around.
What do the prosecutors have to prove in this case? If they say bribery occurred, what do they have to prove?
Well, it's interesting. One of the things that we like to say at Common Cause is that the real scandal is what's legal, not what's illegal. The way that the Supreme Court has interpreted campaign finance laws, essentially it has to be an absolute quid pro quo in order for someone to be found guilty. You know, that that in return for the, you know, the gifts, they're, you know, that the gifts are a separate thing from the campaign contributions. But on the campaign contributions, which are huge here, right, $600,000 to two super PACs, you know, a very direct kind of almost a fee for service thing has to be proved. But from our point of view, you know, the real wake up call here is to change the campaign finance system in ways that simply prevent the kinds of huge contributions to not to candidates through super PACs or through 501c4, you know, social welfare, so-called social welfare organizations. And that that I think is the thing that it's not a loophole, it's a truck hole that we have to close in our campaign finance system.
And I do want to get to that. But in terms of quid pro quo, I mean, to find that smoking gun, I mean, would it be an email or something caught on tape? Thanks so much for, you know, helping us out on this particular issue. And oh, by the way, here's, you know, here's some money for your reelection campaign. Does it have to be that overt? To prove actual, you know, quid pro quo or bribery?
At least close to that. You know, there needs to be obviously what Senator Menendez is now saying is that, you know, what he did for Dr. Melgen was not in return for the financial services or the gifts provided, but out of friendship. So the case will have to be made in order for a successful guilty prosecution that it was the money that was and the actions that Senator Menendez took were in return for the money. And that's a fairly high bar, although you would think that the Justice Department would have felt that that high bar has been achieved before they brought the case.
I mean, clearly friends with benefits, yes? if this is proven.
Definitely.
And are elected officials allowed to do special favors for friends that they might not do for other people? I'm trying to understand his argument.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, I served for 10 years in the Connecticut State Legislature and 4 years as Secretary of the State. And, you know, you start to, you know, see that in some ways there's a tremendous amount of transactionalism in politics. People are always calling you for, a recommendation for their kid to get into college or for intervening on some case that they have. And I think, you know, in part, this is politics, plain and simple. Where I think it becomes really problematical is when huge amounts of money become at stake. And that is an area that the Supreme Court has opened up with its Citizens United case. And I think that, it's one thing to do a favor for a friend. It's another thing to do a favor for a friend who's just given you $600,000 for your campaign. So I think if people who are elected officials need to understand that that's a kind of an unacceptable, close to pro quo if not. And I think that what we need to do as people who care about public policy is look at the system that allows this to go forward, legally speaking, and try to close these loopholes.
We've done some interviews on this about how we fund campaigns, and one of our guests recently, Zephyr Teachout, talked about the fact that the Supreme Court has really narrowed the definition of what is considered bribery. Would you agree with that?
Oh, very much so. I think she's spot on about that. I mean, this goes back, frankly, to the Buckley v. Valeo case in 1976, where the Supreme Court, I call that the original sin of campaign finance jurisprudence, where they ruled that for a candidate, in that case, James Buckley, who was running for Senate in New York, for him to spend as much money as he wanted on his campaign was constitutionally protected free speech. And when they made the equation that spending money, no matter how big, on a campaign was free speech, they opened up an enormous Pandora's box. And since then, the Supreme Court has only worsened it, you know, through a variety of decisions, most recently the Citizens United case in 2010, and even more recently, the McCutcheon case just last year. And what basically it says that anybody can give as unlimited amounts of money in a political campaign, through a variety of mechanisms, and it's really the Wild West now in campaign financing. And I just think that's a shame. I think our democracy is really jeopardized by the fact that when someone wants to run for, you know, an office like the U.S. Senate or certainly president, the first thing that they need to do is find some millionaires and billionaires who will bankroll a super PAC for them. And that's sort of like, you know, standard equipment now for a major candidate is to have a super PAC where your millionaires and billionaires can park their support for you. It doesn't have to be that way. It's not that way in other countries. Some states have made real changes, and this is something that's got to be a high priority for everybody in politics.
Miles, we have an email from Susan. She says, the sad thing is it sounds like Menendez doesn't know the difference between friendship and corruption either, or what is ethical behavior, how to figure it out. No process, no protocol. But what you're saying and what I've heard other people say is that unless the government can really prove quid pro quo, there's nothing particularly illegal about what he has allegedly done. True? Not true? Or is this where it gets complicated?
Yes, it's very complicated, and I'm sure there will be a detailed and lengthy court case about whether this was actually a criminal act on the senator's part. But I go back to saying what's really criminal is what's legal in our campaign finance system today. We have a system that you could almost call legalized bribery in the first place. Anybody who runs for office who gets, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars, wait till we see the 2016 presidential election. You know, cannot but be beholden to the people who give them that kind of money. You know, and it's not just a question of who gets their phone calls answered first. You know, these people, it's almost like a patronage system now where, you know, people who will keep Newt Gingrich's campaign alive, which Sheldon Adelson did in 2012, you know, are just, they're an essential part of the system, but they have a very narrow interest, which is usually protecting their business interests or their personal interests or their narrow ideological interests. We've given them an enormous amount of power in our system, and I think we as citizens have to try to take it back.
And that's Miles Rappaport. He's the president of Common Cause, a group you've probably heard of. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan citizens lobbying organization wanting more openness and honesty and accountability in government. We called him up to get his response to the allegations, the charges against New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez has been charged with a number of counts of corruption. Of course, it's up to the government to prove whether there was corruption or bribery or quid pro quo. To join the conversation, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. I'd be curious about what you make of these allegations so far. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. Miles, I do want to quote something. Yeah, did you want to say something?
I just want to say, lots of ways to get into the conversation. Congratulations. But B, I do think – I don't want to sound so pessimistic. Mm-hmm. I do think there are absolutely things that the federal government can do and that state governments can do. I mean, first of all, the FEC could do its job and create regulations that really make it clear, you know, brighten up the line of what's permissible at what points during campaigns. Some state legislatures, including in Connecticut, have created voluntary public financing systems or small donor public financing systems. New York City has one where a candidate can get the money that they need to run a reasonable campaign without going the route of hitting up millionaires and billionaires. And I think we would be far better served. A small amount of money, a tiny amount of money, relatively speaking, from the federal government could finance all of the campaigns, with a reasonable amount of funds and just get us off of this treadmill. So I think there, both at the state level and at the federal level, there are public policies that can be changed, which would really make a difference in this situation. We wouldn't eliminate the kinds of gifts and bribery that have always been in politics, but we could eliminate the huge amounts of money that are at stake here, and that give people in public office an incredible attraction to doing the kinds of things that are alleged here.
What about the Disclose Act? Would that be helpful?
Yes, absolutely. Because I think that I do think that it is true that if people know who is giving money to a campaign, they can make judgments and they can draw connections and connect the dots between what a candidate's position in it is and who his or her backers are. So, yes, I think disclosure is one thing. I think public financing is another thing. At some point, I think we have to change our fundamental jurisprudence, either through a constitutional amendment that makes it very clear that Congress and the states do have the right to regulate campaign finances and contributions to campaigns, or at least get sufficient public pressure that the Supreme Court, not this Supreme Court, mm-hmm. but a future Supreme Court, reviews these cases and says, what were we thinking? I do think that we're going to look back at some point on these cases, the Buckley case, but certainly the Citizens United case, the way we look back on the Dred Scott decision, which is how could they possibly have thought that allowing this kind of money into our political system was a healthy thing for our democracy? It can't be so.
What's the chance, though, of the U.S. Congress tackling this issue? Because it's a system that favors them, especially with the numbers of incumbents that get reelected.
Well, I think it's a tough uphill battle to get Congress to act on something like this. But I do think that the thing that's encouraging to me is that I think there is much more public conversation. And not only when a Senator Menendez gets indicted, but I think people are really understanding that there's something fundamentally flawed about the way we finance campaigns in this country and the way we make it more difficult than it should be for people to vote. And to the degree that this becomes part of the public conversation, then I think, public policy will follow. And some, in Chicago just a few weeks ago, voters voted in the primary for mayor. Voted 80-20 in favor of enacting a public financing system for Chicago and Illinois. It was an advisory referendum. But I think people all around the country are starting to say, we need to take this into our hands. We need to change it. It may start at the local level, work its way upwards through the states, and then finally get Washington's effective attention as opposed to their, verbal attention.
And effective means do something about it?
Yes, that's usually what effective means.
Okay. Just checking on my English there. Let me get your response to Senator Menendez. Defense attorney Abby Lowell said, prosecutors get to write the indictment they want after a secret, one-sided presentation to the jury. And, of course, Senator Menendez should have his day in court, and it looks like that he will. But there is a criticism of grand juries, I guess, and also of prosecutors, is that they get to indict the ham sandwich, if you know what I mean.
Yes, I mean it's a. I'm not a super expert on criminal justice matters, but I do think that the grand juries have a responsibility to act judiciously and not indict the ham sandwich, but only indict where there's serious stuff. I would not assume that has not been the case with Senator Menendez and the Justice Department. I think they've looked at this for a very long time. But ultimately, it is true that there is a trial and people get to present their case. And if the federal government can't make the case, then he'll be acquitted. But I think it's also, a good warning to everyone in public life that these are the kinds of things that you just have to avoid, plain and simple.
And it
astonishes me how many of our elected officials, don't learn that lesson until it's too late.
Like Aaron Schock?
Yes, he's another one.
And a very recent one. Let me get David from, looks like Flemington, New Jersey, to join us. Hi, David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
In the interest of full disclosure, I'll say first that I send money to Common Cause. Secondly, I don't like either the Republicans or the Democrats. And my question is this. I certainly don't agree with what Senator Menendez has done, but I don't see any difference between that and the fact that politicians get huge amounts of money from big corporations, hedge funds, extremely wealthy people. And if a corporation or a hedge fund gives a politician $1 million but gets $10 million back because of what the politician does for him, that's a clear quid pro quo. That is clear bribery. Why is that different from what Senator Menendez has done, which I think is wrong also?
Well, it's a good
Why is he being attacked and these others are just walking?
It's a good question, David. Thanks for calling in. Miles Rappaport, do you want to take that?
Well, first of all, I'll thank him for his contribution. I hope it wasn't $600,000. Then I'd really owe him.
You would
very much.
Yes, indeed.
But I think the point that David is making is really in some ways the essential one, which is that what's wrong here is the system of incentives, the system of what it has to take to run for office. It takes millions of dollars to run for office, and anyone who goes into that. Field, I don't want to call it a game, it's not a game, it's very serious, knows that one of their huge obligations is to raise money. So the average, I've seen statistics all over the lot, but the average congressman and senator, they spend 40 or 50% of their time raising money. And they're not calling, working class women who are having trouble paying for childcare. They're calling people who can have disposable income of thousands or tens of thousands of dollars, and it skews the public debate. So I think that we have to really look at it, and I do think that that David is right, that there's a lot of major league donations that are coming into the political system that is what we call interested money, and they are expecting returns on that investment, whether it's in the public policy about gambling or whether it's public policy about health care, no matter what it is. I think when you have people and a system that allows them to make huge contributions, whether it's to a super PAC or to a social welfare organization or to a political party.
We got to go. I'm sorry to do
problem,
that to you.
I agree. Okay.
On that kind of rough note at the end, Miles Rappaport, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. President of Common Cause. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowane. Risa Vetri Furman, the Montgomery County District Attorney, is going to decide whether or not to file criminal charges against Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane. A grand jury reportedly recommended that Kane be charged with perjury and other crimes for leaking information to the Philadelphia Daily News regarding a 2009 grand jury investigation of Jerry Mondesir, former head of the Philadelphia chapter of the NAACP. This is just the latest chapter in what has turned out to be a tumultuous first term for the Commonwealth's first female attorney general. Joining us is Brad Bumstead. He's been covering this tangled story for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. He is state capitol reporter for the Review. And Brad, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much, Marty. And tangled is a good word for it.
I couldn't decide which word to use, and I thought tangled was kind of benign enough. But it is a story with many tentacles, if I can put it that way. Brad, what did the grand jury recommend from what you know?
Well, from what we know, and we know this from court documents released by the Supreme Court and a document from the supervising judge of the grand jury, William Carpenter, that it recommended that she be charged with perjury and obstruction of justice, official oppression, and some other charges, including criminal contempt. And that's in a publicly filed document. However, the grand jury report itself has not been released, so we don't know what the evidence is. And, of course, grand juries are meant to be secret, which is part of the whole issue here with the alleged leak to the Philadelphia Daily News about Mr. Mondesir.
And what was that grand jury investigation? This goes back, 6 years?
Yeah. I mean, it had to do with alleged financial irregularities. But the point is that Mr. Mondesir was innocent then, and he's innocent now, and he's never been charged with anything. I've been looking at this a lot lately and thinking about it, and prosecutors across the country leak information all the time. It happens all the time. I've been the recipient of leaks. but it's usually about a pending announcement the next day that somebody's going to be, the grand jury is going to release a presentment or an indictment or something like that. And the difference here in this case, at least according to the allegation, is that she leaked this to the Philadelphia Daily News, and that hurt the reputation, presumably, of Mr. Montesar, who wasn't charged with anything by the grand jury, the attorney general's office. And that is a key difference, I believe.
Well, and she doesn't deny this. In fact, that's a part of, I guess, an interesting defense. According to her defense lawyer, Lanny Davis, he said she never illegally disclosed jury-protected information in violation of her oath of secrecy. So there's no question about whether or not she did this. Is that right, Brad?
Well, there is, however, a major question about what it is that she leaked. She acknowledges, and she told reporters right before she testified before the grand jury in November that she did provide information to the Daily News. But she contends that what she provided was from a 2014 summary of some sort, and that it was not protected grand jury information. And further, her defense is that even if it was, she was not sworn member of the 2009, a sworn prosecutor to the 2009 grand jury. Others have said, but as attorney general, you take the oath of office to uphold the Constitution and therefore to uphold all laws of the state, so that doesn't matter. But that's a dispute. But clearly, she denies leaking any illegal grand jury information that was confidential from 2009. But apparently, the Daily News got both 2014 and 2009 documents.
Oh, interesting.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. And this, as I said, this is a tangled case, but I'm picking your brain here, Brad. Did anyone in her office advise against the release of this information?
Well, apparently so. Now, the Philadelphia Inquirer published a story 2 weeks ago, I want to say, and it said that her former chief of staff, Adrian King, had sent an email at one point to Kane, saying you can't release this information to a law firm. She wanted to, first run it past some law firm. Mm-hmm. He was saying you can't even do that. You can't release this to other people. But somehow this did wind up in the hands of Chris Brennan, who is a great reporter with the Philadelphia Daily News, and you can't blame him for writing it, but how he got it is what's in dispute.
It seems like for Kathleen Kane and Frank Fina, it seems like whatever story you read about the two of them, they're together within this story. Is there a connection between this release of grand jury information and Frank Fina himself?
Well, yes, and it's twofold. One is that Frank Fina and Mark Costanza, both of whom now work for Philadelphia District Attorney Seth Williams, and both of whom were former top state prosecutors, sent a letter to Judge Carpenter initially saying, we've been contacted by the Philadelphia Daily News about this. We believe there's been a serious grand jury leak, and it ought to be investigated, but we can't even go into this in a letter. We need to talk to you in person, which they subsequently did, I believe. But in any case, this letter was made public from FINA, and that's the genesis of all of this. But in that letter, it never named Kathleen Kane. Huh. It never accused her of anything. It barely mentioned the attorney general's office. All that they were saying, all we know is this reporter got this, and he's not supposed to have it, and that could be a serious crime by whoever released it. It's tied that way with Mr. Fina. Secondly, also, the allegation is that this document was released to the Philadelphia Daily News to try to hurt Fina somehow, to embarrass him, because this came after the so-called sting investigation, which she blamed Fina for in part. And this was the case of former current legislators and a former traffic court judge taking cash and jewelry in the latter case, videotaped by an informant under the attorney general's office, came to prosecute that case.
And it's being prosecuted by Seth Williams.
It is indeed, yeah.
In Philadelphia. Let me just quickly reintroduce you, Brad, and that's Brad Bumstead. He is a state capitol reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. We called him up to help us walk through some of the charges, I guess, and countercharges that Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane could face. She faces criminal charges recommended by a grand jury. It's really up to the Montgomery County District Attorney whether to file those criminal charges or not, take the recommendation of the jury. If you have any questions or comments, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Brad, this is Risa Vetri Furman. She's the Montgomery County District Attorney, and really the ball is in her court whether or not to charge the Attorney General, Kathleen Kane, with a crime or crimes or not. What kind of pressure on her do you think it is?
Well, there'd be a lot of political pressure because she's running for judge as a Republican. So she's running in a primary and then in a general election in a county that's trending Democratic and has elected a lot of Democratic office holders of late. So she would face pressure from some Republicans to say, look, you know, here's a ball down the middle of the plate. Are you going to hit it out? Charges recommended by a grand jury, which has the blessing of the Supreme Court in the sense that they said it was, in essence, that it was done properly. They didn't throw out Kane's petition to say that the special prosecutor was appointed in an illegal way. So you have that, and then on the other hand, there could be some backlash and support for Kane among Democrats if, you know, she charges her. Lanny Davis, her attorney, has argued that this is all along has been an effort by angry Republican men to do her in, which, you know, that's interesting. But that, of course, doesn't count Seth Williams, who's a Democrat.
Well, interesting. And there was a long profile of Kathleen Kane in the Philadelphia Inquirer, a very interesting profile, actually. And one of the things that she said in several different ways was that she does feel to some degree that she's been targeted because she's a woman. She's the first female attorney general in Pennsylvania. How does that play in Harrisburg?
She's used that argument. I don't think in Harrisburg it really makes any difference. People are trying, like, in Harrisburg, like anywhere else, to find out what the truth is here. What is, you know, in that grand jury report, what evidence is there? Just speaking to someone about that whole issue of motivation in regard to something else and the person in the legal system, and it often comes down to, Republican Tom Corbett was playing politics when he indicted a number of Democrats and bonus gate and other things. And Joan Orry Melvin, a Republican, claimed that she was done in by a Democratic prosecutor. Mm-hmm. The bottom line is there evidence or not to take to a jury? Did you do it or didn't you do it? And in both of those cases, you had conviction. So that's what people here and elsewhere, I think, want to know is what evidence is there?
And what about the current governor, Tom Wolf? Has he made any comments about Kathleen Kane?
Not of late. I think during the campaign he may have said something, but they are not close by any means. And it's believed, at least among political players, that even prior to this whole thing sort of exploding in December and January, that Wolf had, what might we say, kept his distance from Kathleen Kane.
You had an interesting story, Brad. When Kathleen Kane went before, I guess was giving testimony in Harrisburg before, I guess, some committee in the legislature, it sounds like she was asking for more money for her office.
It was, yes.
But you said really she didn't really have to take any questions on any of these issues we've been talking about.
No, not really. I mean, there was maybe one question, sort of a comment that was thrown out. Subtly, but no, basically it was a love fest. She got from Republicans and Democrats, she got a lot of praise for her work with her mobile street crime unit and work that she's done to fight against drugs. Now, you know, just looking at it on its face, that's to her credit that these people think she's done a good job in that regard. Looking at it a little more cynically, is that a lot of parochialism involved, and these legislators are concerned about drug problems in their districts, and they don't really care whether the attorney general is a Republican or a Democrat or in trouble or not. So anyway, there wasn't a lot of there was no tough questioning to speak of, and that's a bit of a disappointment. You think there would at least be a couple people that would say, look, you know, why you want more money, but you didn't prosecute the Sting case, so why should we give you more money? But that didn't happen.
But that didn't happen. Interestingly, now, so far, two newspapers, including actually the Philadelphia Inquirer, had called for her to step down. Is there any way to sort of read pressure for her to resign? Obviously, she gets her day in court as well, and we don't even know whether she'll go to court or not, whether the Montgomery County DA is going to charge her or not. But is there pressure coming from any angles, even beyond newspapers, for her to resign?
I don't know whether there are Democrats behind the scenes urging to her resign. I do know that Bob Brady, the chairman of the Philadelphia Democratic Committee, had said something critical and suggestive of that. But I forget what the exact remark was quite a few months ago. But, you know, it was a signal that the Democrats are not, you know, fully supportive of her at this point. So she says she's running for re-election next year. What kind of support she'll have depends on how this plays out, but it's going to be tough regardless. Even if she's not charged, okay, let's say that Risa Furman does not charge her. That's great for her, and even when she is charged, she's still innocent. But if that doesn't happen, any political consultant can take all the stuff that's come out about what the grand jury recommended and put that up in an ad if they have a candidate with any money. So that's pretty brutal stuff that's out there about her. So, but the editorials don't help. That's for sure. Both the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Harrisburg Patriot News have called for her to step down. Mm-hmm. And you know, the interesting thing about the Patriot editorial was it said that, you know, it's no one thing that she did. It's this collection of events that put them together, and it's reason for her to step down.
One more question before we have to say goodbye to you, Brad. Her chief of staff actually resigned after just 4 months on the job. What do you think? Is there a significance in that, do you think?
Well, apparently he left on a good note, at least in terms of the email that he sent around the office and her comments about it. There was no outward animus that was expressed. But it was such a short stay, and it was only significant because it was one of many people who have left her employ over the past 2 years, from Adrienne King, her chief of staff, to four. I guess she's on her fifth spokesperson at this point. And, you know, people have left for a variety of reasons. There's rarely a single reason, but it's a parade of people who have left her office. And that impression in the political community doesn't help.
Well, Brad, thanks for walking us through this tangle of a story. That's Brad Bumstead. He's state capitol reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Brad, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. And we spoke earlier in the hour with Miles Rappaport. He's the president of Common Cause. We were talking about the charges against New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez. And we began our conversation in this hour with Matt Friedman, who has been covering politics in New Jersey for the Star Ledger. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Do you like these kinds of segmented shows where we take you from one news story to the next? We'd be curious about what you make of that. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.